This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Critics have called David Payne the most gifted American novelist of his generation. He's best known for his fictional work, like Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street and Early from the Dance. But in the past decade, he has been inching farther and farther away from fiction. He even started to take his own advice that he gives to his creative writing students: write about the hardest material you can. His new memoir, Barefoot to Avalon, does just that. It tells the story of his younger brother, George A., who struggled for years with bipolar disorder and died in a car wreck. David's going to be reading from the memoir to a number of local bookshops around the state over the next few weeks. He joins me first in our studio. David Payne, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Very happy to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. This is a departure for you. What led you to this?
Well, it's interesting. You talked about that advice that I give my writing students, and I think one of my very first creative writing teachers way back in the 70s gave this assignment that I now give to students, which is to write a letter that says the thing you most need to say and could never say to the person you most need to say it to and could never say it to. And I have my students, I always read my version of that letter to them before I make them read theirs. And when people read those letters in class, it becomes a little bit like one student described it as like church. When people share those things that they're most nervous about, afraid of, ashamed of, the things that they think they share with no one else, it touches the deepest chords, and people who don't know each other are brought together in that experience. And I've seen that happen over and over again. And I think, in a way, this was my letter that I needed to write, and ultimately to my brother, to my family, to myself, and to readers as well.
Well, this is a memoir that actually tells the story of your relationship with your younger brother, George A. Tell us about him.
George A. was, you can see him on the cover of the book. There's a sepia photograph of him standing on the beach at the Outer Banks in 1975 as a very handsome, tall 17-year-old about to go back to play football in high school. The story of the title and of the cover is that he wanted to make the football team. He had to run a sub-6-minute mile. And I was a runner in those days, so we would every day we would go out and run together. And I would pace him from our house up to the pier at an Avalon Pier in Kildevil Hills. And on the way back, I would leave him behind.
This is about a 2 mile, so 4 mile.
It was
round
a four.
Trip,
yeah, it was
right?
A 4 mile round trip. So one day toward the end of August, right about this time of year, when I picked it up in the last mile, he picked it up beside me, and it became this sort of grueling hell for leather sprint. In the last 20 yards, he pulled away and he beat me that day. Went back, won a starting position on the team, had a kind of a glory season. And sadly, toward the end of that season, he had his first bipolar episode. And we didn't know what it was at that time. It went undiagnosed for several years. But he went on in between the episodes that he had to have a good life and a full life. He became a stockbroker. He married. He had children. He was successful. But eventually the illness defeated him.
How long was it? You talked about that first episode really in high school, but then they came more frequent, and at a certain point he got a diagnosis, right?
Right. The first episode was in 1975. The second one was in 1980 when he had been hired by Merrill Lynch right out of UNC and went to Atlanta and was in their Buckhead office, and he had the second episode there, and the doctors in Atlanta diagnosed him.
You talk about your willingness or your effort, I guess, to sort of talk him through it. You had sort of dabbled in some of these psychological ideas yourself and thought that you might be able to help him by sort of talking him through it, right?
Yeah, and I look back at that. I was a 25-year-old who'd never had a day of therapy, but I'd read, I'd gotten very interested in psychology in college and had read Jung's autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and he talked about his own breakdown after, you know, in 1912, after he broke with Freud, and how he sort of worked his way through that. And in my naive and rather grandiose way, I thought if I could, maybe if George A. and I could talk through it and we could figure out what was bothering him. And of course, it seems absurd now, but it was the only thing that I knew to do, was to come home and take those walks and have those talks with him. And when I look back at that now, there's an image in the book at the beginning of Dr. Zhivago, when you see the funeral procession with a line of priests carrying the funeral bier, and behind them are the Ural Mountains. And that's how I see that time now, as us, as like this tiny group of figures with the backdrop of his illness and bipolar I disorder and life and fate behind us. And it was much bigger than I knew or than we knew, and too big for us to take on. But that was the way I tried.
Well, and in many ways, another backdrop to this memoir, and also in some ways the subject, it acts as both a kind of shadow but also a focal point, is your brother's death in the car accident. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, my brother, after his last major episode, went home to live with our mother, and we sort of waited for him to regain his footing, and he never did. And he was there for 9 years at the end of his life. And we became estranged over that period of time. And not exactly estranged, but we talked less frequently, and I came home less and less. And then I got into trouble in my career and was packing up my house to move from Vermont back home to North Carolina. And I didn't have the money to hire a moving company. And my mother asked me, well, how do you plan to get here? And I said, I guess I'll get a truck and pack it. And she said, well, why don't you ask George A. to help you? And within an hour, he was on the phone calling and offering his help. So I picked him up in Albany, New York, and within a couple of hours, the two of us were cracking jokes and playing music to each other. And we had these 8 days where we took that house apart from the attic to the crawl space, and it really closed the gap between us. And the night before we left, I was driving a big 26-foot U-Haul truck, and he was following me in my Ford Explorer with a trailer. And we were sitting in the meadow out in front of the house, and I tapped on the window. And he was in there smoking a cigarette. I didn't really want ashes in my ashtray, but I managed not to say anything to him about that. And I said, thanks, George A., you're a good brother. I couldn't have done this without you. And he said, it's okay, David. And those were really the last words that we ever spoke together. We drove for several hours that night to Binghamton, New York. And the next day we got up and drove for about 8 hours. And the accident occurred near Lexington, 3 hours from home.
It was something you viewed in your rearview mirror.
I saw it in the big side mirror of the truck, stopped the truck in the middle of the highway, ran back, tried to help the emergency workers pull him out of the car, but he was already gone.
You write in this memoir a kind of prayer that you made at the time, a desperate prayer. And maybe I could ask you to read from that for us, and we can talk a bit about it.
Please, God, don't make me carry this. Don't make me responsible. Let my brother be alive. I require it of you. I compel you, because if he isn't and I'm responsible, then the universe is intolerable and I return my ticket. Yet the sky was empty and returned no answer, and here I am.
David Payne reading from his memoir, Barefoot to Avalon, A Brother's Story. Here you are. You didn't return your ticket. How long had you been carrying that as a burden before you chose to write about it?
I it was about 6 years after the accident. I think in the wake of the accident, I was grieving without really dealing with it, without dealing with the possibility that maybe I had shown bad judgment in allowing him to drive at all. Was that the reason that it happened? Was it just an accident? My career was in trouble. My marriage was in trouble. I was drinking too much. Things were really had come to a bad way with me. And I was in Pawleys Island, South Carolina, at a book event for my last novel. And I came back to the hotel. It was like a voice said, it's time to write about George A. And where did it come from? From my unconscious, possibly. But it's one of those, all of my books have had that sense of something that's not daily life, intruding into daily life and giving it almost as an assignment. And I knew at that moment that that was what I had to do. And of course, my worry was what would the effect be on others in my family? Would this have any relevance to other people? But I think one of the things that I thought about was those letters that we read in class over and over again, and how those things that seem to isolate us and make us that are the hardest and most frightening to talk about, when we speak about them truthfully, tend to resonate the most with others. So that was my hope.
Well, you chided yourself a moment ago for a kind of naivete at hoping that some kind of Jungian conversation would fix things, would cure things. And yet, that break for Jung was precisely that. That's when he dove into the depths of his own soul and met the ugliest part of all humanity deep in himself and acknowledged it and worked and brought it to the surface.
And that's where we got the Red Book. And he wrote later that everything that he had accomplished in his career came out of that time and that decision to, as he said, consciously submit to the impulses of the unconscious. And I think that's what I was trying to follow in writing this book. I got some sort of order from my unconscious to do it, and I had to obey.
I wonder if the letter that you have written and shown to your class as the sort of starter letter, has that changed since you wrote this book? Have you gotten deeper and found a more difficult passage to write?
Well, the one that I share with the class is in this book, as a matter of fact. It's the first one that I wrote. The one that I would write now, I think, rather than speaking so much to others about things that I might have suffered at their hands, and now is more about things I have done, things that I am the perpetrator of. I think that if I learned anything along the path, it's that, you know, reclaiming more and more of that is the key, I think.
Well, and one of the things the book does so beautifully, and I think in a sublime way, is not provide answers. You know, when you say something like, well, he wrote the Red Book, he plumbed the depths of his souls, and then he came out. And you have the sense that, well, that was a cure. Now he's feeling better, and he can be happy and collect butterflies. But it's not that. There are no answers here. It's just that you have a different way of that you still sort of gather sticks and carry water. Nothing changes before or after the Enlightenment, but that you see things in a whole, that you understand those stories in a different way.
Right. There is no final answer. We're mortal and we're going to die, and the best that we can do is to live as fully as we can and understand as much as we can, but we can't alleviate the fundamental ill.
You talked about thinking about this and reflecting on it and seeing it in terms of your own writing, and your therapist talked about a kind of hypomania described. A feeling that you had after writing a book as hypomania, and this sort of way in which the world created patterns. You could look out over the water and start to see hexagrams, and wondered if George A. wasn't doing the same thing as a financial advisor or a broker. Is this kind of patterning, the sort of these deep symbols that don't mean anything in as you look at them, and then you churn them over and over again, and they suddenly, or maybe over a long period of time, develop meaning.
Well, I think if you look at, if you read, for instance, Kay Jamison's works about bipolar illness, you realize how many writers and people who have been very successful in many fields have, you know, bipolar illness or hypomania, some degree of it. I mean, Virginia Woolf and Graham Greene, and, you know, the list just goes on and on. So I think that there is some connection between the kind of heightened activity that occurs in mania and accomplishment, but there's also it can go over a certain edge into psychosis when it becomes terrifying and destructive. And I have never been over that, but I think that's the little understanding that I have of what my brother's state of mind might have been is based on the sort of heightened experiences that I've had toward the end of writing almost all of my books. For instance, the Confessions of a Taoist, when I was 26 or 7 years old, for about 3.5 months, I was working 18 and 20-hour days, and I would go to sleep and try to go to sleep, and I would jump up 10 times and write down notes about the next scene, and day and night sort of lost their meaning, and I would write in the middle of the night, and so on and so on. So I imagine that there's some of that in me, and that my brother had a more severe degree of it.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but more nonfiction for you, or are you moving back to fiction?
I'm thinking that there's another nonfiction piece that I need to write about my father, but I have not been given the assignment.
You haven't heard that voice yet. Well, when you do, please come back. David Payne, it's been a pleasure talking with you. The new memoir, Barefoot to Avalon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Frank.
You'll be reading from the book at Purple Crow Books in Hillsboro tonight, the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Thursday. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.